Chapter 35. The sequel of my resolution. For anything I know, I may have had some wild idea of running all the way to Dover, when I gave up the pursuit of the young man with the donkey cart, and started for Greenwich. My scattered senses were soon collected, as to that point, if I had. For I came to a stop in the Kent Road, at a terrace with a piece of water before it, and a great foolish image in the middle, blowing a dry shell. Here I sat down on a doorstep, quite spent and exhausted with the efforts I had already made, and with hardly breath enough, to cry for the loss of my box and half guinea. It was by this time dark. I heard the clocks strike 10, as I sat resting. But it was a summer night, fortunately, and fine weather. When I had recovered my breath, and had got rid of a stifling sensation in my throat, I rose up and went on. In the midst of my distress, I had no notion of going back. I doubt if I should have had any, though there had been a Swiss snowdrift in the Kent Road. But my standing possessed of only 3 halfpence in the world, and I am sure I wonder how they came to be left in my pocket on the Saturday night. Troubled me nonetheless, because I went on. I began to picture to myself, as a scrap of newspaper intelligence, my being found dead in a day or two, under some hedge, and I trudged on miserably, though as fast as I could, until I happened to pass a little shop, where it was written up that ladies' and gentlemen's wardrobes were bought, and that the best price was given for rags, bones, and kitchen stuff. The master of this shop was sitting at the door in his shirt sleeves, smoking, and as there were a great many coats, and pairs of trousers dangling from the low ceiling, and only 2 feeble candles burning inside to show what they were, I fancied that he looked like a man of a revengeful disposition, who had hung all his enemies, and was enjoying himself. My late experiences with Mr. and Mrs. Micawber suggested to me, that here might be a means of keeping off the wolf for a little while. I went up the next by street, took off my waistcoat, rolled it neatly under my arm, and came back to the shop door. "If you please, sir," apostrophe I said, "I am to sell this for a fair price." Apostrophe, Mr. Dolloby. Dolloby was the name over the shop door, at least took the waistcoat, stood his pipe on its head, against the doorpost, went into the shop, followed by me, snuffed the 2 candles with his fingers, spread the waistcoat on the counter, and looked at it there, held it up against the light, and looked at it there, and ultimately said, "What do you call a price, now, for this here little waistcoat?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Oh, you know best, sir," apostrophe I returned modestly. "I can't be buyer and seller too," apostrophe said Mr. Dolloby. "Put a price on this here little waistcoat." Apostrophe, "Would 18 pence be?" Apostrophe, apostrophe I hinted, after some hesitation. Mr. Dolloby rolled it up again, and gave it me back. "I should rob my family," apostrophe he said, "if I was to offer 9 pence for it." Apostrophe, this was a disagreeable way of putting the business, because it imposed upon me, a perfect stranger, the unpleasantness of asking Mr. Dolloby to rob his family on my account. My circumstances being so very pressing, however, I said I would take 9 pence for it, if he pleased. Mr. Dolloby, not without some grumbling, gave 9 pence. I wished him good night, and walked out of the shop the richer by that sum, and the poorer by a waistcoat. But when I buttoned my jacket, that was not much. Indeed, I foresaw pretty clearly that my jacket would go next, and that I should have to make the best of my way to Dover in a shirt and a pair of trousers, and might deem myself lucky if I got there even in that trim. But my mind did not run so much on this as might be supposed. Beyond a general impression of the distance before me, and of the young man with the donkey cart having used me cruelly, I think I had no very urgent sense of my difficulties, when I once again set off with my 9 pence in my pocket. A plan had occurred to me for passing the night, which I was going to carry into execution. This was, to lie behind the wall at the back of my old school, in a corner where there used to be a haystack. I imagined it would be a kind of company to have the boys, and the bedroom where I used to tell the stories, so near me. Although the boys would know nothing of my being there, and the bedroom would yield me no shelter. I had had a hard day's work, and was pretty well jaded, when I came climbing out, at last, upon the level of Blackheath. It cost me some trouble to find out Salem House, but I found it, and I found a haystack in the corner, and I lay down by it, having first walked round the wall, and looked up at the windows, and seen that all was dark and silent within. Never shall I forget the lonely sensation of first lying down, without a roof above my head. Sleep came upon me as it came on many other outcasts, against whom house doors were locked, and house dogs barked, that night, and I dreamed of lying on my old school bed, talking to the boys in my room, and found myself sitting upright, with Steerforth's name upon my lips, looking wildly at the stars, that were glistening and glimmering above me. When I remembered where I was at that untimely hour, a feeling stole upon me that made me get up, afraid of I don't know what, and walk about. But the fainter glimmering of the stars, and the pale light in the sky, where the day was coming, reassured me. And my eyes being very heavy, I lay down again, and slept, though with a knowledge in my sleep, that it was cold until the warm beams of the sun, and the ringing of the getting up bell at Salem House, awoke me. If I could have hoped that Steerforth was there, I would have lurked about until he came out alone, but I knew he must have left long since. Traddles still remained, perhaps, but it was very doubtful, and I had not sufficient confidence in his discretion or good luck, however strong my reliance was on his good nature, to wish to trust him with my situation. So I crept away from the wall as Mr. Creakle's boys were getting up, and struck into the long moldy track which I had first known to be the Dover Road, when I was one of them, and when I little expected that any eyes would ever see me the wayfarer I was now, upon it. What a different Sunday morning from the old Sunday morning at Yarmouth. In due time I heard the church bells ringing, as I plodded on, and I met people who were going to church, and I passed a church or two, where the congregation were inside, and the sound of singing came out into the sunshine, while the beadle sat, and cooled himself in the shade of the porch, or stood beneath the yew tree, with his hand to his forehead, glowering at me going by. But the peace and rest of the old Sunday morning were on everything, except me. That was the difference. I felt quite wicked in my dirt and dust, with my tangled hair. But for the quiet picture I had conjured up, of my mother in her youth and beauty, weeping by the fire, and my aunt relenting to her, I hardly think I should have had the courage to go on until next day. But it always went before me, and I followed. I got, that Sunday, through 23 miles on the straight road, though not very easily, for I was new to that kind of toil. I see myself, as evening closes in, coming over the bridge at Rochester, footsore and tired, and eating bread, that I had bought for supper. One or two little houses, with the notice, lodgings for travelers, hanging out, had tempted me, but I was afraid of spending the few pence I had, and was even more afraid of the vicious looks of the trampers I had met or overtaken. I sought no shelter, therefore, but the sky, and toiling into Chatham, which, in that night's aspect, is a mere dream of chalk, and drawbridges, and mastless ships in a muddy river, roofed like Noah's Arks, crept, at last, upon a sort of grass-grown battery overhanging the lane, where a sentry was walking to and fro. Here I lay down, near a cannon, and, happy in the society of the sentry's footsteps, though he knew no more of my being above him than the boys at Salem House had known of my lying by the wall, slept soundly until morning. Very stiff and sore of foot I was in the morning, and quite dazed by the beating of drums and marching of troops, which seemed to hem me in on every side, when I went down towards the long narrow street. Feeling that I could go but a very little way that day, if I were to reserve any strength for getting to my journey's end, I resolved to make the sale of my jacket its principal business. Accordingly, I took the jacket off, that I might learn to do without it, and carrying it under my arm, began a tour of inspection of the various slop shops. It was a likely place to sell a jacket in, for the dealers in second-hand clothes were numerous, and were, generally speaking, on the lookout for customers at their shop doors. But as most of them had, hanging up among their stock, an officer's coat or two, epaulettes and all, I was rendered timid by the costly nature of their dealings, and walked about for a long time without offering my merchandise to anyone. This modesty of mine directed my attention to the marine store shops, and such shops as Mr. Dollaby's, in preference to the regular dealers. At last I found one, that I thought looked promising, at the corner of a dirty lane, ending in an enclosure full of stinging nettles, against the palings of which some second-hand sailors' clothes, that seemed to have overflowed the shop, were fluttering among some cots, and rusty guns, and oilskin hats, and certain trays full of, so many old rusty keys of, so many sizes, that they seemed various enough, to open all the doors in the world. Into this shop, which was low and small, and which was darkened, rather than lighted by a little window, overhung with clothes, and was descended into by some steps, I went with a palpitating heart, which was not relieved, when an ugly old man, with the lower part of his face all covered with a stubbly gray beard, rushed out of a dirty den behind it, and seized me by the hair of my head. He was a dreadful old man to look at, in a filthy flannel waistcoat, and smelling terribly of rum. His bedstead, covered with a tumbled and ragged piece of patchwork, was in the den he had come from, where another little window showed a prospect of more stinging nettles, and a lame donkey. "Oh, what do you want?" grinned this old man, in a fierce, monotonous whine. "Oh, my eyes and limbs, what do you want? Oh, my lungs and liver, what do you want? Oh, guru, guru." I was so much dismayed by these words, and particularly by the repetition of the last unknown one, which was a kind of rattle in his throat, that I could make no answer. Hereupon the old man, still holding me by the hair, repeated, "Oh, what do you want? Oh, my eyes and limbs, what do you want? Oh, my lungs and liver, what do you want? Oh, guru." Which he screwed out of himself, with an energy that made his eyes start in his head. "I wanted to know, I said, trembling, if you would buy a jacket. Oh, let's see the jacket. Cried the old man. "Oh, my heart on fire, show the jacket to us. Oh, my eyes and limbs, bring the jacket out. With that he took his trembling hands, which were like the claws of a great bird, out of my hair, and put on a pair of spectacles, not at all ornamental to his inflamed eyes. "Oh, how much for the jacket?" Cried the old man, after examining it. "Oh, guru! How much for the jacket?" "Half a crown," I answered, recovering myself. "Oh, my lungs and liver," cried the old man, "no. Oh, my eyes, no. Oh, my limbs, no. 18 pence. Guru." Every time he uttered this ejaculation, his eyes seemed to be in danger of starting out, and every sentence he spoke, he delivered in a sort of tune, always exactly the same, and more like a gust of wind, which begins low, mounts up high, and falls again, than any other comparison I can find for it. "Well," said I, glad to have closed the bargain, "I'll take 18 pence. My liver." Cried the old man, throwing the jacket on a shelf. "Get out of the shop." "Oh, my lungs, get out of the shop." "Oh, my eyes and limbs, guru. Don't ask for money. Make it an exchange." I never was so frightened in my life, before or since, but I told him humbly that I wanted money, and that nothing else was of any use to me, but that I would wait for it, as he desired, outside, and had no wish to hurry him. So I went outside and sat down in the shade in a corner. And I sat there so many hours that the shade became sunlight, and the sunlight became shade again, and still I sat there waiting for the money. There never was such another drunken madman in that line of business, I hope. That he was well known in the neighborhood, and enjoyed the reputation of having sold himself to the devil, I soon understood from the visits he received from the boys, who continually came skirmishing about the shop, shouting that legend, and calling to him to bring out his gold. You ain't poor, you know, Charlie, as you pretend. Bring out your gold. Bring out some of the gold you sold yourself to the devil for. Come. It's in the lining of the mattress, Charlie. Rip it open and let's have some. ... and many offers to lend him a knife for the purpose, exasperated him to such a degree, that the whole day was a succession of rushes on his part, and flights on the part of the boys. Sometimes in his rage he would take me for one of them, and come at me, mouthing as if he were going to tear me in pieces, then, remembering me, just in time, would dive into the shop, and lie upon his bed, as I thought from the sound of his voice, yelling in a frantic way, to his own windy tune, The Death of Nelson, with an O, before every line, and innumerable garrus interspersed. As if this were not bad enough for me, the boys, connecting me with the establishment, on account of the patience and perseverance with which I sat outside, half-dressed, pelted me, and used me very ill all day. He made many attempts to induce me to consent to an exchange, at one time coming out with a fishing rod, at another with a fiddle, at another with a cocked hat, at another with a flute. But I resisted all these overtures, and sat there in desperation, each time asking him, with tears in my eyes, for my money or my jacket. At last he began to pay me in halfpence at a time, and was full 2 hours getting by easy stages to a shilling. Oh, my eyes and limbs! ... he then cried, peeping hideously out of the shop, after a long pause, will you go for 2 pence more? ... I can't, I said. I shall be starved. ... my lungs and liver, will you go for 3 pence? ... I would go for nothing, if I could, I said, but I want the money badly. ...
It is really impossible to express how he twisted this ejaculation out of himself, as he peeped round the doorpost at me, showing nothing but his crafty old head.
Will you go for 4 pence? ... I was so faint and weary that I closed with this offer, and taking the money out of his claw, not without trembling, went away more hungry and thirsty than I had ever been, a little before sunset. But at an expense of 3 pence I soon refreshed myself completely, and, being in better spirits then, limped 7 miles upon my road. My bed at night was under another haystack, where I rested comfortably, after having washed my blistered feet in a stream, and dressed them as well as I was able, with some cool leaves. When I took the road again next morning, I found that it lay through a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.